Good afternoon. Welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat that's going to be looking at the SEC's role in accounting standard setting. We're pleased that you could join us for this broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Mark Beasley, Deloitte Professor of Enterprise Risk Management and Director of the ERM Initiative in the Poole College of Management at North Carolina State University, based in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I will be serving as your moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chats are made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. Through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, the SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge on the history of financial regulation from the 20th century to the present. The virtual museum and archive is free and accessible worldwide at all times and currently welcomes more than 300,000 visitors annually. Both the museum and the society are independent of and separate from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The Society is grateful for the sustained and generous support of Deloitte LLP in making the Deloitte Fireside Chats possible. The Deloitte Fireside Chats debuted on the SEC Historical's website in 2009 as interactive programs on current issues in financial regulation that would be of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. Past programs have addressed the role of professional judgment, principles versus rules-based accounting and auditing standards, regulation in the audit profession, and responsibility for preventing and detecting financial reporting fraud. Earlier this month, Professor Mark Peacher at the University of Illinois at Champaign led a discussion on the role of the auditor. All of these programs can be accessed anytime in the Deloitte Fireside Chat section under programs in the virtual museum and archive. Today, I'm very pleased to have with me here to look at the SEC's role in accounting standards three panelists. First, Loretta Cangiolosi, Senior Vice President and Controller of Pfizer, Inc., is joining us, along with Bob Keppers, who's the Deputy CEO of Deloitte and a trustee and president-elect of the SEC Historical Society, and Art Wyatt, who's a retired partner from Arthur Andersen & Company, a former professor at the University of Illinois at Champaign, as well as a former member of the AICPA's Accounting Standards Executive Committee and the FASB. Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Deloitte LLP or of the SEC Historical Society. The Society selected me to moderate the program. I have worked with the presenters to determine the topics and questions that will guide the content of our discussion. We've actually centered our discussion today around three themes that we plan to cover, and let me just walk through briefly the three themes. The first we're going to touch on is the historical perspectives of the SEC's role in accounting standard setting. After that discussion, we're going to move into a more focused discussion on the factors, things that have influenced that role, just to help us sort of understand some of the influencers to that process. And then we want to conclude the session today, focus more on the role of the SEC in accounting standards now in 2011 and then beyond. So let's begin our theme by focusing on theme number one, that historical look at the SEC's role in accounting standard setting. You know, I'm a professor, and so one of my jobs is to introduce students who are new to the profession to the accounting world, but particularly standards in accounting. And it's interesting as I think about it, when we look at this particular topic on the SEC's role in accounting standards, you know, since the 1930s, the SEC has delegated its authority for standard setting pretty much to the private sector. So if you're in my shoes, introductory course in accounting, how would you give someone who's new to the profession, how would you describe what this delegation looks like? What is that? Bob, let me start with you on that.
Sure, Mark. I'm happy to do it. I guess one way I think about this is as we sit here today, now a 70-plus-year-old public-private partnership in many ways, because clearly by statute the authority to define accounting terms, to determine the form and content of financial statements filed with the commission. That clearly has been delegated by Congress from the beginning of the SEC in the early 1930s. But historically, and starting particularly in 1938 with something called Accounting Series Release Number 4, the Commission has sort of recognized that the private sector, in particular the accounting profession, has expertise, energy, and resources that, without abdicating its responsibilities, has allowed or permitted those standards to be set by the private sector. Taking it a little more current, of course, we're all familiar with the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, which has actually been in business since I began the profession in the mid-70s, 1973. And at that time, the SEC sort of reaffirmed its delegation of authority, again, without abdicating its responsibilities in this area, to the FASB, and, you know, continued their policy of looking to the private sector for leadership in establishing and improving accounting principles. One thing that, as a practical matter, is important to realize, though, that the SEC staff in administering the securities laws has to make decisions on narrow issues all the time. And what I love about ASR 150 from December 20, 1973, it's about a page and a half. But it has everything you really need to know. And at the end, it says, look, it must be recognized that when we administer the federal securities laws, we being the SEC, and when we review filings under the acts, the commission staff will continue, as it has in the past, to take whatever action it needs on a day-to-day basis to make individual decisions to resolve specific problems of accounting and reporting. Because, you know, we all recall that the SEC is all about making certain the markets continue to function. So the SEC itself has a substantial day-to-day authority, but the longer-term evolution of accounting standards is done under its guidance with that delegated authority.
Loretta, is anything that you would add if you're sort of standing in my job, you know, my role as an accounting educator, that would help give the students some perspective of what that looks like?
I would say, you know, certainly they don't abdicate any authority. They delegate, but with some oversight. And so I think it's important, and I know Art's going to get into this, but it's important to recognize that when the SEC was formed, the folks at the SEC realized that they were not experts in accounting, nor did they want to necessarily be experts and promulgate accounting principles. So they needed to work in partnership with the auditors and the accountants to come up with this, because they basically had a budget of about $300,000 when they started. So not a lot to hire the staff of today, where they have more staff who are accountants, understand this. But as far as the delegation, you know, they do have different observations that they make from time to time. They do work closely with the Emerging Issues Task Force, whether it's been at the very beginning with the Committee on Accounting Procedure, which was the group in the 1930s, moving to the Accounting Principles Board, then the Financial Accounting Standards Board, and perhaps someday it will be the International Accounting Standards Board. But all of these, they have delegated their authority to, but watched over and participated and given guidance. So that's what I would add to that.
Okay. Art, you're a student of history. Can you give us a little historical context of how this sort of delegation agreement came about back in the 1930s when the SEC was first created?
I'll try. Before we get into that, I think your students would grasp better what went on if they related the issues to some of the current issues on our political scene. At the time we are talking, the 2012 political campaign is heating up, and one of the overriding issues is what should the role of government be and how much intervention should government have into the private sector. In the 1930s, this issue came into focus because of the effects of the stock market crash, and the blame was placed in large part on those scoundrels that misused financial statements and misled investors. At the time the commission was created, it had five commissioners, as it does now, and the party that had the White House control had three from his party or her party, And the minority party had two representatives. So the commission was comprised of three Democrats and two Republicans. As Loretta said, and Bob as well, the people on the commission were not leading accountants. Most of them were lawyers, some businessmen. And they recognized that the resources they had, with the resources they had and the expertise they had, maybe there were others in the society better equipped to deal with the actual approval of the standards. So on the one hand, you had those who wanted the government to control it, and the other hand, you had those who wanted the private sector to have control. The interesting thing to me is that the chairman of the commission at the time, Joseph P. Kennedy, who was famous in his own right but later became famous as the father of Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Teddy Kennedy, voted with the two Republicans to keep the standard setting in the private sector. And that was a crucial decision, and not unlike some of the decisions that we are likely to see faced in the coming months. So that then, of course, ASR 150 was maybe the most important accounting series release the SEC ever issued, because it, in effect, as Bob indicated, continued the support of the SEC for the private sector with the recognition that SEC oversight was crucial to the process. And that has continued down to this day.
Do you see ASR 150, did it take it in a totally different kind of direction, or do you think it was on a pretty consistent path that just sort of continued down that?
I think it continued the path.
Okay.
I don't think there was any break at that time in the pattern that had been evolving. There was a need for the Accounting Principles Board to be replaced for a variety of reasons. And the replacement took the standard setting out from under the AICPA, which had kind of morphed from a professional body into a trade association, and created an independent body. And the SEC was merely saying, these are where the experts are. We will work with them. We think it will work the way it's been working. That's my impression.
Let me just add, this is Bob. That last point, I think, is critical, because we were now saying that the complexity of the business issues that need to be dealt with through accounting standards are no longer work of a part-time committee. Mm-hmm. We're talking about seven, named board members who, as a full-time job with the requisite full-time staff, as opposed to an activity that, great work was done for decades, but these were practitioners and other people who had different responsibilities, and now we're saying we need sort of specialists here to be dedicated full-time to the pursuit of better accounting standards. So it was a big change, and the fact that the SEC got behind it is the only reason it's still there today.
No question,
I think.
Well, Bob and Art both, you have a unique lens on this whole interaction between the SEC and the private sector, because, Bob, you were in the chief accountant's office at one point in your career. Art was on the FASB and AXAC. So, Bob, can I start back with you a little bit? What are your observations of, is there anything sort of curious or anything controversial, let's say, about how you saw that delegation actually play out in real life?
Well, the intersection in my mind was the need for the commission to deal with issues of the moment. So there was an IPO that the company wanted to have go effective and raise new capital. There were accounting issues that came out of the review in Division of Corporation Finance. Those things had to be resolved. And in the process of getting to the right answer, the SEC staff, particularly in the Chief Accountant's Office, had a tremendous amount of latitude to research the issue, come to the right answer. And what I found in my own experience at that time, date myself a little, but purchases and poolings took up more than half of my time, is that I always called Art Wyatt and try to get the right answer. But the truth is, there was, on a daily basis, outreach to the firms, outreach to the standard setters, outreach to other experts, so that we were not dealing with a staff that was just sort of making ad hoc decisions, you know, decision du jour. This was very careful, and there was a deep sense of responsibility that whatever answer you give today could be the precedent for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So, I actually felt that it was sort of seamless between government and private sector, and if it was a big policy issue, there's no question there would be, maybe not public, but more behind the scenes, consultation with people who might have a reason to weigh in so that the decision would stand.
Mm-hmm. Art, is that, yeah, how's your experience come?
I would agree with that. I think Bob and I independently in talking about this issue a few weeks ago recognized that both the FASB and the commission had this sort of unwritten policy of mutual non-surprise, where they would keep each other informed of their thought processes. And I think that the FASB members always recognized that the SEC, the Chief Accountant's Office, had the big club. Mm-hmm. Okay. So therefore, in our reasoning at the FASB, we had to do the best we could to come up with a reasoned policy that was consistent with what else was going on. Otherwise, the SEC was going to overrule us, and that would tarnish our reputation. So this worked, and there were. I think you need to recognize that the Chief Accountant's Office had, in my experience, Andy Barr, who I worked with, and then Sandy Burton, and several others subsequent. But the two of those two men were totally different personalities, but very similar intellectually and in their desire to see the standards that were set best serve the investing public. And so the people at the FASB, especially the initial board members, were of similar caliber, and it worked. Mm-hmm. Because the people made it work.
And I do think, to that point, Art, the what develops over time, and of course you've got folks turning over at the SEC, the chief accountants do come and go, the staff certainly does as well, and board members turn over, but the institutional trust that's sort of you walk into as a new person, you know, becomes part of the culture in which you operate. And had that never developed, or you know, you sort of live by the letter instead of the spirit of cooperation, mm-hmm. I just think we could have had a major change in the system, but it wasn't necessary, because the deep sense of responsibility that both FASB board members and folks at the SEC felt, you know, we're sort of all pulling for the same thing. And when you keep investors in the forefront and, you know, getting to the right answer for the right reasons, it's worked actually quite well over the years.
Lines up pretty nicely. So when you think about that, you know, we're probably all envisioning, you know, setting FASB kinds of standards. But we know Loretta particularly as a playing a role in registrants' accounting selections and reporting. The SEC does other things that could influence accounting standards. Mm-hmm. For example, staff accounting bulletins, comment letters on filings, and then even speeches that are made publicly. Can you give us a sense for your view on how that has influenced sort of accounting choices, particularly from a registrant's perspective of having to monitor all that?
So I think, you know, from a historical view, there probably was a lot less of that going on. However, with the technology we have today and the ability to disseminate information so rapidly, every time that the staff makes a speech, it pretty much is a shot heard around the world once it gets posted to the World Wide Web. Same is true of the comment letters that they make. Now, comment letters are, as they say, very specific to a registrant. However, many companies pick them up and say, oh, well, they got this comment. You know, we don't want to get that comment, so we'll do what they did. You can now get those off the web as well. So, again, all access to a lot of information is a great thing, but I think in some ways it has become a part of the unofficial, perhaps, language of accounting. People do read them. They do interpret them. They do analogize them. We know that many firms put out publications around the comment letters, what comes out. We do have the AICPA gives a conference every year. It's at the very end of the year, and generally they invite members of the staff to come down and give speeches. And the speeches are generally about specific focus topics because the staff tends to work with focus topics and allows the standard setting to deal with the more broad-based topics. However, pretty consistent when those messages go out that all of a sudden those speeches are taken apart, analyzed, analogized, and somehow new gap gets created. So there are those pitfalls, and I realize that the staff generally is trying to react to something very specific that's happening in the market, some specific disclosure that they're looking for. It's very difficult. We work with financial statements, which tend to be historical. Therefore, they're always looking back. I think the staff, certainly tries to be a lot more proactive in some of the things. But again, they're always having to react after. So financial instruments is one. You can rely on speeches to come out about financial instruments just about every year, right, Bob?
Exactly.
Do you see a difference? I mean, when you think about this way of influencing accounting standards, do you see a difference between, say, staff accounting bulletins versus a speech versus a comment letter? Or
Staff accounting bulletins are most definitely authoritative. People know that that's the rule. You need to be following that. Staff accounting bulletins are really good because they give you the reasons why. You understand what they're trying to do. It goes through more of a due process, whereas the speech gap, when it comes out, is kind of this is the way it is and this is the way the staff interprets accounting. So it's the staff's interpretation of accounting, which registrants say, ergo, it is the way the SEC wants us to do this. So it becomes authoritative in its own right. Mm-hmm. And that's the way registrants generally think about it. Comment letters, a little less so, other than we do hear from accounting firms, we've seen a trend of people getting comment letters around their disclosures of taxes in different jurisdictions. Okay, so then all of a sudden, everybody will be looking at that disclosure. Gee, what are they after? Why do they want it? So it gets a lot more play now than it ever did before because those letters are now public. Previously, they were not, I think up until about, 5 years ago, Bob? They were not public. Now they are public. And so it gets a lot more play. And people are always looking, for what's out there, what should I be doing better, what's the right thing to do. I think for registrants as well as accounting firms, we live in such a dynamic environment. We are not bricks and mortar anymore. We are very much into intangible things. People in 1938 could never have conceived of a cell phone. And when I sell a cell phone or an iPad, I'm selling a piece of hardware and a piece of software. And what is this software thing that I'm getting, because I can't see it. So there's a lot, the environment's gotten a lot more complex, and the SEC has also had to get a lot more complex, but also continue to rely on the experts that Bob noted to come forth with the right accounting.
But Loretta, as a preparer, you and your colleagues in the preparer community have kind of a challenge, because the only thing worse than getting some new guidance on accounting in December is getting it in January. the conference you referred to used to be in early January, and now you couple that with the fact that all the big companies are getting reviewed each and every year, right? Essentially, if for whatever reason you choose not to heed the advice that's in the speech, then the presumption is you're going to get a comment when your filing is reviewed, mm-hmm. And yet we're struggling, with our clients, and our clients struggle themselves trying to figure out, if something sort of drops on the table at that time of year, it shouldn't be a surprise, but sometimes it is. And that's a mechanism that's designed, I think, to narrow practice or to sort of solve a problem, but it's a weird time of year to have to deal with.
I agree. I think, though, in a lot of cases, what they're attempting to do is give people a heads up on what their expectation is. I think a very interesting dynamic that we've seen play out over the last year has been on FASB 5 dealing with contingencies, where the FASB basically was trying to come up with a new rule on contingencies. A lot of constituents came back and said, not workable, you don't understand, this is very complex stuff, we can't do all this, we can't fair value it, these disclosures are too much. So basically, the FASB came back to the SEC and said, you know, you see what's happening here. And people are saying that it's the way it's being enforced is not right. Mm-hmm. So the SEC made very good on their promise and basically went out publicly and said, we're going to be looking at the enforcement of this. And I think that's been quite true. So that's another way in which the SEC kind of provides oversight as well as assists the FASB in trying to either prove or disprove the theory of it's the enforcement.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you think, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is the staff accounting bulletins, yet, as you mentioned, have a little more formality to them, and while they're not, you know, statements of the commission, they're also not issued without full knowledge of the commission and comfort that it's appropriate. I always felt the staff accounting bulletins were fairly narrow. They were designed to maybe take practice that was divergent and sort of make it more consistent. The one I remember working on myself was the, I don't even remember the number anymore, it was 61, I think, but it's repos and reverse repos, repurchase agreements in the savings and loan industry, because we were starting to see some incredibly different treatment in the financial statements of SNLs in the mid-'80s, and we felt we had no choice. As a staff, to act quickly. Many things have happened since then and make it a little less normal to have a staff accounting bulletin, but I think they served a very important purpose, and they always came out sort of in the throes of some controversy, mm-hmm. and it added finality to the issue so that people mm-hmm. knew exactly what they needed to do.
Yeah, the objective, it seemed to me, from my perspective, was to stop a proliferation of what the staff believed was a weak practice, and to do it on a timely basis. The FASB might have been able to do it, but their due process requirements did not permit them to operate on a timely basis most of the time. So I think it worked reasonably well. The speech thing, you know, that bothers me, because there's no due process, and sometimes, depending on who's the speaker, you get less thought than you might expect you would get. And I don't think that's happened very often, but there have been chief accountants that have spoken a little more off the cuff than others.
Which actually provides, I think, a nice segue into our second theme. That being more looking at factors that have influenced sort of that SEC's role in the accounting standard setting. We've touched on this a little bit. Even, Loretta, you brought in sort of the current context in the speech area. But I'd like to focus specifically on sort of getting your viewpoints on how have politics, sort of the political environment in our country, had an influence over the 80 years of this delegated authority. You know, we've seen changes in presidential administrations, congressional administrations. How have you sort of observed the Washington political scene, if you want to think of it that way, having an influence on accounting standards? Art, can I get you to respond to that?
I view the politics at two levels. One is the Washington scene, and the other was the lobbying by the business community of the FASB members. But taking the first one, I think it's pretty clear that politics played a role in the oil and gas accounting decisions that the commission made. Politics later intervened with regard to accounting for stock compensation.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two that come to my mind. You know, most of the politicians are not CPAs. Most of the politicians that I dealt with, eyes glazed over when you started talking about accounting standards, unless it was something that was at the heart of their district. On the other side, the lobbying by the business community of the FASB had enormous influence in many areas. I think back to lease accounting. The FASB statement, 13, I think it was, only required about 600 pages of interpretations. And the reason was that the statement was illogical, and it was illogical because the leasing industry just wouldn't accept what – they didn't like the answer. That's generally what happens in the political process. A group doesn't like the answer, so they lobby to get it softened. It happened in the pension area. There are a number of areas where if you took a clean piece of paper, you would not have come out with that result. That has had, I think, more of an impact on the nature of the standards than the political process from Washington.
Lord, I'd be curious if you have any observations or, you know, from a controller's perspective in an industry, you know, how yes. you've seen that play out.
So, you know, when I look at, you know, what does Congress want? Congress looks after kind of the economic health of our country. And so their agenda is not specifically aligned with where the SEC is, which is they're really looking out for the investor. That's their mandate. So you do have these two different agendas going on. And so when you get to something like pensions, I'm sure that at the time there was a lot of lobbying going on that this was bad for business and, you know, profits would go down and people would be hurt. And so as a congressman, that's a political problem. And so there is more likely to be that pressure on the SEC to come off of a position that they may not like. We do see, though, with politics, I mean, I think you really have to look at the politics, the economic environment, and what's going on with the SEC and accounting, because all of these things are intertwined, and they do all mix or not mix together. So every time there's a crisis, whether it is an Enron and we get variable interest entity accounting or special purpose entities or a Madoff or whatever it is, there's a reaction to it. Mm-hmm. The accounting itself has changed dramatically over time from being very income statement focused to being very balance sheet focused, and now we've added a layer of comprehensive income focus. So these things change over time, and the politics works its way through them. So I don't think you will ever be able to divorce yourself from that, but understanding and kind of being a student of history and looking at what happens and what can happen, you can learn a lot from the politics. I mean, the economy and the running of the economy is critical and key to Washington. It's key to business people. But that's why the standard setter really has to stand out there in the private standard setting, because they are really the independent voice. They do need to be balanced with cost versus benefit. Mm-hmm. But that's another consideration of their job.
Loretta, you raised one thing that you were so close to going there. I just want to complete the thought. Let's say there's an accounting issue that might have an impact on company earnings, and it gets the attention of members of Congress and some thoughtful member of the House Financial Services Committee or the Senate Banking Committee writes a letter to the SEC saying, you know, I think this is an important issue. We certainly hope that you are going to follow through on this with the FASB. And that's in its oversight role, I have no issue with that. Where it makes me nervous is when members of Congress decide that they're actually going to establish accounting standards by statute, which may be totally incongruous with the securities laws and many other things. And it the precedent of that always worries me. If we start heading down the road where a random member of Congress connected with some other piece of larger legislation – can change the accounting rules that way, which they would have the authority to do, they always do, that just feels to me like we're heading down a road that is not good. It tends to undermine the SEC and the FASB. And so that's the one place I would draw the line, saying when things get emotional, sometimes folks introduce legislation, and then I think it really threatens the system.
Do you, as you think about it in history, you know, if, again, I'm drawing on you to help me teach my classes. If you were to give me, what would you say was the best example of where politics probably stepped in the most? Was it the oil and gas or the SNL crisis? Does one stand out, I guess, as you think back through that historical process?
Well, I wouldn't pick one.
Okay.
Let me pick something a little different. You know, the FASB was formed because of the perception that the APB members, not only being only part-time, but they were susceptible to being persuaded by their clients to do things a certain way. And then there was lobbying within the APB. APB 16 and 17 ended up in two standards instead of one because they couldn't get 12 votes for the one standard. Splitting it in two, they could get 12 for each. The FASB came into being, and one of the objectives was to get the politics out by having a conceptual framework be developed. And if we look at some of the weaker standards that the FASB has issued, we can see that they didn't follow the concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So we still hear 40 years later, we don't have perfection. And we may never get perfection because there are those who will lobby and there are those who will threaten to write a law, and they have the power to do that. And so when that surfaces, it seems to me that it behooves the FASB and the SEC to do what they can to counteract it. And so this is a tension that won't go away. I, as a techie accountant, I would like everything to be conceptually sound. That's my job was to reason through to an answer and disregard the politics. But that's not the real world.
Yeah.
The real world is there are going to be forces, and we have to learn to deal with them. And I think that overall, the combination of the FASB and the SEC has done a pretty good job in serving the investing public.
Bob, again, you had a tour of duty through the SEC. I'd be curious from everybody, but I'll start with Bob. Do you see one of the factors in this process even being linked to somewhat the personality or focus of the person who is sitting in the SEC's chief accountant seat? You know, that rotates. So does this ebb and flow a little bit?
No question that the orientation or agenda or conceptual sort of framework of the chief accountant can really make a huge difference. And I will say that we haven't talked about the chief accountant as a position yet, but I mean, I always say the chief accountant is basically the king of accounting in America because that one position, a government position, has more influence than any other one in our profession that I can name. So you've had chief accountants that were sort of legendary in terms of their vision, or just super solid and had a nice long run. So the Andy Bars and was just as solid a guy as you'd ever want. And Sandy Burton, very different fellow, as we were talking before, but intellectually an equal for sure. Mm-hmm. And then if I go into the more recent era, I worked for Clarence Sampson and Ed Colson in my time there, but Clarence was one of Andy Barr's proteges. And then in more modern times, we've had a little shorter tenures. The most recent chief accountant, some have been true reformers. Others have
attempted reformers.
We were talking before about is there anything that you kind of look back on and say, I wonder if that really did any good? And we've had a couple of cases where chief accountants have had strong interpretations that were new, leading to, in some cases, hundreds of companies having to restate their
mm-hmm.
financials. Now,
right.
There's no elegant way to get from here to there, so restatement is one route. But at the end of it all, with all the cost of that today for a big company, I don't know whether we've moved the needle or not, but it's still, even that was within the spirit of getting it right. Mm-hmm. And so we've been very fortunate to have great chief accountants over the years, and it's such an important position that I think the influence of that individual on the office, and then as it cascades through the private sector, the agenda they set, the signals they send, is very, very important.
Art, I'm curious about your take on that, too, because you know many of these personally, have known them.
Yeah, I think I would agree with Bob. I think I have to give maybe higher marks to Andy Barr than anybody, because he had to deal with very strong personalities in the individual accounting firms, the titans of the industry, where some of the names were names that everybody in the business community would recognize. That's not so true today. Most of the leaders of the big firms are more marketing oriented than they are technically oriented. And Andy dealt with those people. He did not have the stature when he started that they did, but when he finished, he had the stature that was equal. And then Sandy came along as a different personality, but he even heightened the perspective of the chief accountant's job. And the king of the accountants is probably a good description, but we've been blessed in having some very good people filling that role.
Yeah, I would say, I like the king of accountants, and it almost has to be, Solomon-esque. In the way that it's done. And I think the more successful chief accountants have been willing to listen, been very thoughtful about their approach, but have also been decisive about what they were looking for. And they have worked collaboratively across, whether it's with business, with the firms, with the investors. And so that ability to work across all of those constituencies really is helpful for them. The ones who have been less successful are the ones who have not been able to listen and have really just pushed their agendas forward or the agenda of the commission. I'm not exactly sure where the agendas come from sometimes. That's what, kind of my viewpoint on the chief accountants.
Just a footnote, the other thing that happens is it really depends on whether the chairman and the other commissioners have a deep interest in accounting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there have been chairmen who either by design or by agenda or by circumstance, learned an awful lot about accounting and auditing due to a crisis. Mm-hmm. In other cases, it's been actually somewhat difficult to find one of the commissioners who's really steeped in the issues and the importance of them. So the chief accountant without a commission,
you can't really look at that
separately. That interplay is really important.
Yeah.
Right.
Loretta, I wanted to come back to you, sort of another factor being the EITF, which was created in the mid-'80s. How do you see that influencing accounting standards and how it's sort of influenced this relationship between the SEC and the FASB? Or the private sector, I should say.
So the EITF is an important group, and it was established. Their main purpose at the time that they were established was really to deal with very narrowly focused issues and to deal with them quickly, things that people could come to a consensus on. The SEC has an observer on that group, so they do watch, they see what goes on. I'm sure they guide when they feel that there's something that doesn't make sense to them. I'm sure they give their opinion. And it was, and has been an effective group in getting things done quickly. I think it does have this kind of cross-functional type group. It does have business people. It has people from accounting firms. It has, so it has different perspectives trying to work on an issue that is narrowly focused. Today, it's kind of morphed into a little bit broader, and we do see some of the issues they tackle really impacting
a multitude of companies, which was not the original thinking, but that's where it's kind of morphed into. And I do think that the SEC finds it a good place to refer issues to through the FASB when they have things come up from registrants or seeing patterns coming up from registrants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The advent of the EITF in 1984, I think, created yet another venue to resolve issues that didn't have to go to the chief accountant's office. And I think the reason it worked well for a long time was the issues were narrow. A consensus could be reached. You know, they kind of met the definition of the kind of thing you could resolve. With that, it was a very visible manifestation of the sort of guidance of the SEC, because if discussion was going fine and heading in a good place, chief accountant didn't have to say a word. On the other hand, if somebody came up with like a loony idea and it started catching on, there would have to be a little signal that maybe we should table this, or you can go there, but we're not going to accept that. You know, I've seen different versions of that. I will tell you one thing, though. The very first issue, 84-1, it was either debt defeasance, or it was a simple issue. The issue summary was a page and a half, and the consensus was like a paragraph. And then as we got years past, I mean, I remember getting 80 and 90 page issues paper with view A, B, C, D. And I kept thinking, I've been out of it for a while. I thought, boy, things have really changed. This used to be, the kinds of issues that were being considered were increasingly complex. So mm-hmm. I still think it helped the SEC. If we can get something resolved by the FASB through a process, great, because then we don't have to issue a staff accounting bulletin or whatever. And so I think it served an important role, and it was not inconsistent with the idea of delegated authority with that partnership mm-hmm. that we talked about.
Before we move off our second theme on sort of the factors influencing the role of the SEC in standard setting, Art, I want to come back to you, because we have a unique opportunity to capture the reality of what it feels like to be influenced, perhaps, as a board member of the FASB. And I'm particularly interested in, there were times where you dissented on a standard. What kind of factors tried to influence you in that dissent kind of process? Does anything come to mind that stands out?
Well, I tried to apply the conceptual framework as I understood it. And that, you have to recognize, came from my background at Anderson, because we had a conceptual framework not too different from what the FASB ultimately came out with prior to the formation of the FASB. And so that was sort of my bias. But you have to recognize that when you have the vote has been, the FASB for a standard has been either 4-3 or 5-2. Sometimes you needed 5, sometimes you needed only 4. But there were always 2 or 3 dissents sitting on the table.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And if you got there first, you got the opportunity to write your views. Whereas if you were in the majority, you had to have your views folded in with the others' views. And on pensions, where I ended up dissenting, I was not a dissenter to the pension standard until we got into the corridor approach, which boggled my mind as where you could turn to in a conceptual framework and find any thread of a support for it. So then I gave me an opportunity to dissent. But I never was, I never felt any indication from anybody at the commission, the chief accountant's office, that I should not be permitted to dissent.
Okay.
That never even entered my mind. And there was respect that if the board couldn't come up with a majority opinion, then we were going to have to act at the commission.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty powerful force for the FASB to make a decision.
Okay. Well, I know just in our remaining time, I want to make sure we get to our third theme. And that really is sort of bringing this SEC's influence in accounting standards into the current context. sort of 2011 and then beyond from now. And sort of to bring it sort of in the current context, I'm curious, and Bob, let me start with you, just in your role at Deloitte. How have you seen the role of the SEC and accounting standards changed, even if at all, as a result of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act? And did that change that dynamic at all as far as influencing accounting?
Well, interestingly, the biggest change, I think, if I think about the Office of the Chief Accountant and the role, it really wasn't in the accounting area. It was in the auditing area.
Yeah.
The formation of the PCOB, the sort of expansion of the office in order to oversee, you know, yet another organization. You know, on the accounting side, in Section 108 of the Act, you know, made it very clear that you could look to another qualified standard setter. I mean, it really opens this discussion up to the whole question of where are we going,
mm-hmm.
and what about international standards versus U.S. standards. And, you know, just for the record, I don't think there's anything wrong with U.S. standards. They are what they are. They've evolved over all these decades, and I'm not suggesting a burning platform that, you know, we need to move on from them. But let's face it, we talked about politics, and Art had two brands of politics that he mentioned. I'll mention a third, and that's global,
mm-hmm.
the emergence of the G20. I mean, when President Bush and Angela Merkel decide that we're going to go to international standards, it's kind of a big deal. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got to listen to that if you're the Secretary of the Treasury or the Chairman of the SEC. So, I mean, in my mind, it just the field has opened up in terms of, well, where are we really heading? And it wasn't so much, I mean, there are elements you can point to in the Act.
Mm-hmm.
But on the accounting side, obviously we've been stable for the last 10 years, notwithstanding the Act, Sarbanes-Oxley. But the real question is, where are we going to go?
Yeah, and I guess maybe somebody looked at that 108 sort of provision, and then the fact that we're still are in the current model as have we embraced, in essence, institutionalized the role of the FASB. But you've introduced the whole, you know, IFRS issue, and I'd like to go there. And Loretta, the listeners can't see you nodding your head at some of Bob's comments, but I sense you were agreeing with some of his conversation about just the reality of the global pressure in accounting standards. What is your take on the current position and sort of where we seem to be going or not going in regards to embracing IFRS from an SEC lens?
So I think the first thing is, it's very hard to argue with the very basic premise of, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we all had the same accounting principles globally? I don't think anybody could argue that. The truth of the matter is, we will never have that because each country has its own economic, and again, economics drive it, issues that they attempt to take care of, whether it's the EU or the Japanese or the Canadians or the Americans. So there'll always be different flavors. You know, we'll start out with vanilla. Some will want to change the flavor. Some will only want to add sprinkles. But there'll always be some changes. So I think that's the first thing to understand. The second thing from what the SEC has developed so far, I think they've put forth a very thoughtful proposal, a proposal that is designed to ease us into position for international accounting standards, being respectful of what the G20 has come forward with. They've needed to react to it. They have not attempted to say just big bang, which they could have. And I think that would have been put a lot of pressure on companies in a bad way for investors because it's too much change happening all at once. The amount of change is not only just in the technical accounting, but for registrants, a lot of systems have to be revamped. So there's cost, again, going back to the economics, and particularly for private companies, there would be costs. That would be, you know, if they were to say, FASB, go away, everybody is on IFRS. So there are attendant costs to that, which, again, this evolving and having the FASB around guarantees that the U.S. will be able to moderate those standards where absolutely necessary to deal with our own economic issues. We have specific litigation issues. We have very specific compensation types that other countries don't have that we need to deal with. So I think what they've put forth is a very thoughtful proposal.
I'd be curious, you know, if we were asked to come back and do this webinar 10 years from today, do you anticipate we would be describing the SEC's role in accounting standards differently in the context of IFRS? I mean, do you anticipate it to be wildly different?
Let me just that's really an unfair question, but let me answer it anyway. let me go back to politics for a minute.
Okay.
I don't think that folks in the United States Congress are going to look kindly on having everything that's done by U.S. companies developed by some international board that happens to physically meet in London, but it really is an international body. That's why I think the FASB would remain crucial as a national standard setter to make the determination of whether, as promulgated or as possibly modified, a U.S. version of IFRS is the way to go. I also think, and I'm just being practical here, the SEC is accountable. The folks they oversee are accountable. And if I'm a member of House Financial Services or Senate Banking, I want to have somebody I can subpoena if there's a crisis or a problem.
Okay.
And so that's why I think, and if you look around the world, this is very true, national standard setters remain. Not because they're writing them from scratch, but because they're acclimating them to the business environments that they're in. So in that way, I think 10 years from now, if this all plays out, we wouldn't be looking at anything too different. But the raw materials that would be the
coming
standards
into the process
would actually be shipped in. Mm-hmm. But then we'd have to do with them as we see fit here in the U.S.
So I wanted to talk about the IFRS issue, but I also wanted to talk about the current economic crisis. You know, Art, you started our hour a little bit of giving us a little perspective on how we ended up with this delegation authority when the SEC was created coming out of the Great Depression. So many argue that the current crisis we're dealing with is the second greatest economic crisis we dealt with outside of the Great Depression. Do you see any lessons that we maybe should have been learning that came out of that Depression era that should be impacting the SEC's current involvement in accounting standards, given the crisis that we're continuing to sort of deal with in our country, in the global world, really?
I don't see that the SEC has dropped the ball in any significant way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the international arena is a wild card. In addition to the points that Loretta mentioned, we have cultural differences that take a long time to change. 10 years may be enough, it may not be for some countries to agree to go in a direction that others are going in. I think the biggest challenge for the SEC is to get comfortable that other countries' securities regulators will enforce the standards even-handedly and in the same manner and the same level that the Commission has tried to enforce the standards. You have three things. You have adoption of standards, application of the standards, and then how those applications are enforced. And we don't have the mechanism, from my perspective in dealing with this arena nearly 20 years ago now, we don't have the cultural development in many countries to see the enforcement in the same way that we have come to accept in the United States. And until we do, I think the SEC has a hard job enforcing the U.S. to follow, U.S. companies to follow international standards.
Mm-hmm. And one quick, if you could just give me a couple, 20-second soundbite kind of thing on one more question. And Loretta, let me start with you. You know, as we wrap up this session, is there anything that would sort of be on your wish list that you wish the SEC might start doing or not doing in this particular area of accounting standards?
I think that, again, they have it's a tall order that they're trying to follow, and being proactive is probably the best way to avoid disasters. It's very difficult to do. I think the only thing that I would probably say, as far as stop doing, would be some of the technology stuff. Being on the leading edge with things like XBRL has caused some concerns for companies. Mm-hmm. I think they went into it with higher hopes, perhaps, than mm-hmm. it actually was. But I think overall, the stuff that they're doing, whether it's comment letters, I'm not saying I love them, but they're necessary, and they go to this issue of enforcement, and that's their job.
I wish we could continue, because this is fascinating for me. I hope it'll be fascinating for my students, because they'll be listening to this at some point, I'm sure. But I do want to just turn to Loretta and Bob and Art, and just to say thank you all for your willingness to join us today to share your insights into the SEC's role in accounting standards setting. Today's program, I think, is going to add to the wealth of information that on accounting and auditing that is already in the museum's collection, and I just think it's awesome that this will be archived for later use. Yeah, it'll be a valuable link in the Richard C. Ackerson Gallery on the subject, which is currently being curated by George Fritz, a retired PricewaterhouseCoopers partner and consultant to the industry, and it will be permanently open in the museum at the end of 2012. The audio of today's broadcast is now available on www.sechistorical.org, and an edited transcript will be prepared soon. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank Deloitte LLP for its generous support and assistance in making today's program and the Deloitte Fireside Chat series possible. Thank you for joining us today. Good afternoon.